As discussed in the last issue of this series by Margaret Tempero, progress in the management of pancreatic cancer has been discouragingly gradual, but there have been some steps forward in clinical trials, and I met with Dr. Ellen O'Reilly to review these data sets, and she began her conversation by presenting a patient from her practice.
So this was a lady in her 50s with really no significant medical history other than hypertension and hyperlipidemia. And she presented with painless obstructive jaundice, sort of a classic presentation for a head of pancreas tumor. Subsequent imaging confirmed that, and she was deemed to have resectable disease and proceeded directly to surgery. Actually, the surgery was performed elsewhere, and she was found to have a T3 moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma with 4 out of 8 lymph nodes involved and a positive deep resection margin and obviously no distant metastatic disease. And her CA19-9 post-op was normal. So at the time that she had come, we did not have an open adjuvant study. That might have been a consideration. So she received standard therapy with gemcitabine. At the restaging point, had no evidence of metastatic disease, and given her positive margin and her vigor, we opted to include chemoradiation to address the positive margin, and indeed hoping, obviously, that it would impact on overall survival.
And I'm curious, I don't know whether this patient actually asked you for numbers in terms of what to expect from the future and how much adjuvant therapy or chemoradiation might affect those numbers, did she?
So this lady did not, but she had a very sophisticated brother and friends who were intimately involved in her care, and I would say were really the decision makers for her, and they really guided and asked the probing questions in terms of relative and absolute impacts of adjuvant treatment.
What kind of numbers did you give to them or her?
So, you know, if people ask this directly, and obviously there's ways of conveying difficult figures, we say more often than not a recurrence is going to happen, and the probability is that it's going to happen within the first year. It's about 80 to 85% of people with pancreas cancer that will ultimately recur. In terms of absolute impacts from treatment, it's pretty clear that systemic therapy versus nothing will increase the time that the patient is alive and free of recurrence. And arguably in pancreas adenocarcinoma, that's important, good quality of life, because uncontrolled disease contributes significantly to morbidity. And I think there's a real but modest survival impact that's translated into a longer-term outcome. But for most people, and certainly for this lady, the estimation was that it would hopefully enhance her time to tumor recurrence, but would probably not cure her outright.
What about adjuvant trials in pancreatic cancer?
So in the RTOG-0848 trial of gemcitabine plus or minus erlotinib, the gemcitabine dosing will be standard, 1,000 milligrams over 30 minutes on the 3-on-1-off schedule, and erlotinib dosed at 100 milligrams daily, extrapolating from the advanced disease trial setting. There was a lot of discussion about whether 150 milligram dosing should be used, but that dosing has only been studied to a relatively limited extent in pancreas adenocarcinoma, and it was felt that this would represent a relatively big extrapolation to commit hundreds of patients to a higher dosing when the data set supporting its use in pancreas adenocarcinoma in combination was finite. So a lot of discussion about that, and that was the final consensus.
Have you treated any patients with that combination outside a protocol setting?
In the adjuvant setting, relatively few, I have to admit. More routinely, for people who are motivated and have bulky tumors and wish to consider more, have incorporated capecitabine as part of standard treatment. Little more data, I think, from several trials in the advanced disease setting. And also, it's the subject of an ongoing randomized trial in Europe, the ESPAC-4 study, which compares gemcitabine plus capecitabine to gemcitabine alone. I can't argue that one choice is better than another, but that personally has been the more common consideration.
Anything happening in terms of predictors of response or benefit from gemcitabine or erlotinib?
So this is a very interesting area and a lot of things being looked at. Firstly, whether nucleoside protein transporters predict for gemcitabine's response. There's some data in the advanced disease setting, some extrapolated from the RTOG 9704 study suggesting that it might predict for gemcitabine's benefit, but not 5-FU. That needs to be tested and validated in a prospective setting. And like all of these predictive markers, I think where the cutoff is drawn has yet to be defined. And so I think we've a lot to learn, and certainly it's not a tool with which one should make clinical decisions at the moment, but this big study provides a very nice opportunity to potentially validate some of the early observations from the previous RTOG trial.
How about erlotinib? Of course, we've seen exciting things in lung cancer, predicting response to EGFR TKIs in terms of EGFR mutations. Has that been looked at in pancreatic cancer? Any clues? What about rash?
Right. So a very interesting series of questions, too. And first thing to say is that EGFR mutations are very rare in pancreas adenocarcinoma, anecdotally have been identified. In terms of the RAS-RASH story that's evolving, there's some recent data from the Gastrointestinal Cancer Symposium from a Danish group that looked at resected pancreas adenocarcinoma. It was a relatively sizable group of patients, 300-odd, and found that the level of RAS mutations was lower than we traditionally think about in pancreas adenocarcinoma. They looked at ampullary patients as well and found that in about a third of pancreas and ampullary patients in the resected population, they had wild-type RAS. So that suggests that there may be a subgroup where EGFR targeting, be it a tyrosine kinase or a monoclonal antibody, may have a role. Very limited data in pancreas cancer looking at targeted agents in this setting, although there will be some at least toxicity information from the ECOG randomized phase 2, which looked at bevacizumab and cetuximab in the adjuvant setting. So arguably there may be a consideration for anti-EGF targeting in this patient population. In terms of rash and pancreas adenocarcinoma, both the Malcolm Moore study from the NCI looking at gemcitabine or erlotinib compared to gemcitabine, and the AVITA trial, which has been presented several times, of gemcitabine or erlotinib plus or minus bevacizumab, both have confirmed the observation that people who develop a significant rash fare better. And that pharmacodynamic marker is proving an ongoing target of clinical evaluation. But as of yet, there's no predictive marker for who may benefit in pancreas adenocarcinoma, except after the fact.
You mentioned these other adjuvant trials. What's sort of an overview of what is being looked at right now in the adjuvant setting and what's being talked about?
So to review what's going on adjuvantly, several key studies, gemcitabine plus or minus erlotinib, that's from the CONCO group, and that's also in the context of the RTOG recently opened 0848, with the second randomization in that study being plus or minus chemoradiation using capecitabine or 5-FU as a radiation sensitizer. In terms of other trials, we've mentioned gemcitabine plus or minus capecitabine, a straightforward one-to-one randomization of, again, nearly 1,000 patients as part of the SBAC cooperative mechanism. Other studies in the adjuvant setting, data are weighted on the randomized phase 2, which was conducted by the ECOG group and looked at bevacizumab and cetuximab in two arms with a gemcitabine backbone and capecitabine radiation backbone on both arms. And that's really a toxicity study. But if there's a signal observed, perhaps it might provide the basis for subsequent phase 3 development. Having said that, that study was conceived at the time before the large phase 3s of bevacizumab and cetuximab in the advanced pancreas cancer setting results were known. So I think one is not holding one's breath there, but either way should provide some interesting insights. Other considerations in the adjuvant setting have been the intensive chemoradiation protocol that Vince Picozzi and the group at Seattle have developed. And just a reminder here, this involves infusion of 5-FU with interferon as a modulator of both 5-FU and radiation, along with cisplatin, followed by 2 6-weekly schedules of infusion of 5-FU. That's the regimen in terms of its original inception. And that was tested in a multi-center setting as part of an ACOSOG phase 2 trial, straightforward single arm, primarily looking at outcome and toxicity. And that study actually met its primary endpoint, although toxicity was relatively substantial in terms of as you might expect, GI toxicity with nausea, vomiting, dehydration, electrolyte depletion, diarrhea, etc., and myelosuppression. But the two-year survival and the primary endpoint was 18-month overall survival were significant in terms of what the study was powered to look for. So the Europeans have sort of embraced this and have several versions modified, including using a lower dose of cisplatin, substituting gemcitabine for infusion of 5-FU, and continuing with the constrained radiation field to try and see whether this is worthy of further development. And they have studies with radiation included and with radiation removed, both an ongoing randomized phase 2 and I believe a small phase 3.
Now, this woman received 5-FU with her radiation therapy. What about capecitabine off study?
So I think that is reasonable, and we've sort of made the extrapolation, and in pancreas adenocarcinoma, that's accepted now, even though there isn't a big data set to support equivalence, but just extrapolating from other diseases in the GI tract, I think it's an acceptable thing to do.
What do you generally do and why?
So if people have a port, we probably would stick with infusion of 5-FU. If they don't or are uncomfortable with the idea of a port, I think given the wealth of data now in the colorectal cancer world and other settings, using capecitabine, flat dosing, BID, 5 days on, 2 days off, schedule in conjunction with radiation seems rational. And the cooperative group and intergroup mechanism have accepted that in the recently opened study.
Now, what about neoadjuvant therapy?
Right. So this is sort of a hot area and an emerging area in pancreas adenocarcinoma. And for the most part, neoadjuvant therapy has been looked at in the context of the bigger academic centers and relatively exclusively in that context. But it really needs to be tested in a more wide-scale setting, as I think there are lots of reasons why neoadjuvant therapy is attractive in pancreas adenocarcinoma, not least of all the biology of the disease and a very high propensity to early systemic failure. So you can just argue the value on its own on the basis of using time to select out patients who are most likely going to benefit from a big intervention such as surgery and select out those that are destined to develop metastatic disease early. When we know in the postoperative adjuvant setting and in the locally advanced setting, that's probably somewhere in the 20 to 25% of patient range. Obviously, one would like to have more compelling reasons to do it, but I think until systemic therapy improves in pancreas adenocarcinoma, that is one reasonable reason. A second one is treatment delivery. And for people who undergo Whipple, about 20 to 25% will have significant morbidity in the perioperative setting that will preclude the timely administration of adjuvant therapy. And that's a concern given that we know that adjuvant therapy works. So again, just on the delivery aspect, by giving preoperative therapy, you get more treatment into more patients, and that may improve outcome.
Now, are you participating in any neoadjuvant studies?
Yes. So we have our own institutional neoadjuvant study, which is a little different to some others. This is for patients with exclusively resectable pancreas adenocarcinoma. So the idea is we're not including borderline resectable patients. And we have benchmarked this against our institutional database for patients with resected pancreas adenocarcinoma that were staged with a CT pancreas angiogram and laparoscopy. So it's a very selected group of patients. And we're looking at 18-month survival as a surrogate for overall survival in a context of a single-arm study. And that's nearly accrued. So we hope to be presenting some data probably at the spring of 2011 on this strategy.
And what's the regimen?
So it's looking at gemcitabine and oxaliplatin based on the use of platinum in the advanced disease setting and some data suggesting higher responses. We deliberately have not included radiation in this just to keep the statistics clean, but the study does permit for patients who have positive margins and otherwise would be candidates for the inclusion of chemoradiation to receive it, but it's not routinely prescribed as part of the trial. The other thing that we're trying to do is to try and develop a xenograft model of people's pancreas malignancy. This is certainly doable from cores that are obtained when patients undergo surgical resection, but what we're trying to do is by obtaining endoscopic cores in the context of the original staging and diagnostic procedure. That's actually proved pretty difficult to get sufficient tissue from body tumors as opposed to tail tumors, where it's technically easier to access. So this is an ongoing work in progress.
So what do you do with the tissue?
So we implant it in a mouse model and see if we can grow up a xenograft of the patient's tumor, with the idea being, as other groups have, to see if we can provide an in vivo model of a patient's tumor for testing for when and if their tumor recurs as to what might have utility in the advanced disease setting. This takes time and has been, as I say, to some extent, relatively labor-intensive, and we've been limited by inability to get sufficient tissue from the pre-treatment setting.
Now, if this woman had presented to you pre-op, would you have put her into a study or treated her off study with pre-op therapy?
So for patients with resectable pancreas adenocarcinoma, we would prefer that if a patient opted not to go on a neoadjuvant study, that they proceed directly to surgery. For patients with borderline resectable disease, and recognizing that that's a mishmash of patients where it can be to some extent in the eye of the beholder as to whether they have a resectable cancer or not, I think chemoradiation preoperatively outside of a protocol setting may be reasonable, although again, one would certainly like to have that patient treated in the context of a study so that we can really learn which patients benefit from this strategy.
So how did this woman tolerate the adjuvant therapy and the chemoradiation?
So this lady had a performance status of zero within about 5 weeks of surgery. So she was a fit, vigorous individual. I would say it's not an overestimation to say that she waltzed through treatment, had grade one toxicities, no significant myelosuppression. And that included two chemoradiation. And in the setting of current chemoradiation, if one is going to administer it, arguably the best timing may be at completion of systemic therapy for several reasons. One, you've selected out the patient who's going to develop metastatic disease early and spare them the potential morbidity. But secondly, patients likely will tolerate it much better because the whole nutritional and digestive issues that are significant challenges in the early weeks to months post Whipple surgery in particular usually have been ironed out. And if patients don't have a good functional status early on, they often do toward the latter part of their systemic therapy, and chemoradiation is certainly better tolerated in that context. So for this individual, she did fine and tolerated chemoradiation very well with really, again, minimal toxicities.
So what was the next step in her course?
So she was followed, and this is a subject of some controversy, how best to follow people with resected pancreas adenocarcinoma. One school of thought is regular CA99 for those that are expressors of CA99 and routine scanning. For others, given that treatment of recurrent disease has modest impacts in terms of overall survival, you can argue that not scanning people routinely may be reasonable. Personally, I think if they've gone through adjuvant treatment, it's sort of hard not to follow people. And certainly in the context of a clinical trial, we definitely do want to follow people. This lady wasn't, but we adopted what we typically do for these patients. And for the first year, usually see them 3 to 4 monthly with CA99 and typically scanning every 6 months. If the marker is going up, that may prompt scanning independent of the routine schedule. So ultimately, her markers did go up, and that was a harbinger for declaration of overt disease. And for a while, she was followed locally and presented somewhat floridly, I would say, at the very latter part of 09, early this year, with pleural effusions, shortness of breath, and significant infiltrates and parenchymal lung nodules.
So at that point, what were you thinking about both on and off study?
So in the context, and this a couple of things, she had relatively significant symptoms and performance status, probably a 1, so decline compared to her original baseline. And certainly this lady needed a response. And outside of a study, in this setting, for an otherwise healthy person, one might favor using a combination of medications. And the data is imperfect from single trials of combination cytotoxics in metastatic pancreas cancer in terms of declaring a survival advantage. For the most part, they universally don't. But pooled and meta-analysis from Heinemann and colleagues and also from the UK group, Sultan and colleagues, have suggested that combinations for good performance status patients and arguably too for patients with symptomatic or bulky disease may benefit. So for this lady, yes, definitely would favor a combination. The other reason, too, is she was previously exposed to gemcitabine, but the time interval from completion of her adjuvant therapy and recurrence suggested that she was somebody who might benefit by going back to a gemcitabine-based combination. This is not something that's been rigorously studied in pancreas adenocarcinoma. Usually we don't have the luxury of large timing between completion of adjuvant therapy and recurrence, and does need to be, but certainly anecdotally, there's evidence that these patients can benefit by returning to gemcitabine. So there's another reason why using a combination and not relying on a single agent appear to make sense here. So outside of a study, our major consideration was to use a platinum combination, just because I think they may have the edge in terms of response rate, and she needed a response, quite symptomatic. Some might argue, based on single institution and retrospective data for multi-drug combinations, such as GTX, and certainly in Manhattan, that's a relatively popular combination of gemcitabine, docetaxel, and capecitabine. That does need to be compared to gemcitabine or gemcitabine and erlotinib in the frontline setting, and such a study is planned, so that will be helpful. In terms of trial considerations, we have two institutionally. They were both actually sort of mini randomized phase twos. One was gemcitabine plus or minus a PARP inhibitor, which is, I think, an exciting class of drugs in at least a niche population of patients with pancreas adenocarcinoma. The concern, though, was that there was at least a third possibility that you might get randomized to single-agent gemcitabine. And the second study was also a randomized phase two in terms of its design, with the control arm being single-agent therapy. And that was looking at a monoclonal antibody. So that was weighed up pretty heavily, but the concern was that she was probably better served outside of a trial. So the other thing that came up in discussion, and this is a very topical area in pancreas adenocarcinoma, was sending tissue for analysis to see if that provided some hints to either the initial treatment of advanced disease or subsequent lines of therapy. And just extrapolating from Dan van Hoff and his group's data with nab-paclitaxel and gemcitabine, which is the subject of an ongoing randomized phase 3 in advanced disease, but that data has got a lot of publicity in the pancreas cancer community, and many savvy patients and families are aware of this and inquire about whether or not they should have their tumor tested for spark protein and what it means and whether they should receive this on or off study.
Do we know enough that if the patient is low on spark or absent spark that they won't benefit?
No, I mean, absolutely. I think this needs to be validated. And if you look at the original phase one, phase two, there were people who benefited who appeared to be spark low. So I don't think one can make any decisions as of now. And this needs to be collated and followed and understood more thoroughly as to whether or not this may be a biomarker of use for this particular class of drugs.
Any thoughts about whether or not NAB is working directly against the tumor as opposed to the stroma?
I don't think we know. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion about that, and some people feel it's both, and that's perhaps one of its attractions, that it's targeting both the profound desmoplastic stromal reaction that pancreas adenocarcinoma, at least in terms of the primary tumor, may induce, as well as the metastatic disease. And the spark binding may be both related to tumor and to the stroma, and it's possible that it's really a delivery system for getting more drug into the tumor. I think we really need to tease this out more, and these are all theories in progress at the current time.
Assuming it can get paid for, do you think there's a role for NAB outside a protocol setting?
Some places have the option to do this. Actually, at Memorial, we don't, because it's a relatively expensive drug and there's not necessarily reimbursement guaranteed. I guess one is somewhat tortured on this one. I think ideally it is preferable to wait until the phase three study matures, until we have a clear signal. But it's the real world and there are options to get it. So I think sort of ethically, we're obligated to let patients know that this is available, whether it's the right thing to do or not, and whether it's a better option or not, we really don't know. And ideally, encourage their enrollment in the context of the ongoing phase 3 to answer this question as expediently as possible.
So have you actually treated anyone?
So I have not, because we don't have the ability to do this outside the narrow FDA-approved indication for nab-paclitaxel at the current time. Have I suggested to patients that it may be reasonable to get this locally? Yes.
You mentioned a PARP inhibitor. What specific ones are being looked at, and what's the biologic rationale?
So there are a number of PARP inhibitors being developed in various cancers, and the one that's probably furthest along in development in pancreas adenocarcinoma is the AZD2281 or olaparib compound, and that's being studied in the context initially of a phase 1 and now sort of an expanded cohort, mini-randomized phase 2, although not at all powered to answer any phase 2 questions, but might provide a signal. This is being looked at in a genetically unselected population, and that's, you know, of potential relevance, as it's thought that homologous repair pathways are important in perhaps up to 30 to 50% of pancreas adenocarcinomas. I guess we're looking for BRCA-ness or some clinical or immunohistochemical or biologic phenotype that may predict for response to this particular class of drugs. There's some anecdotal information on PARP inhibitors in people with pancreas cancer and a known germline mutation of BRCA1 and 2, and responses have been observed. So that's, I think, an exciting observation, but that, again, is a relatively finite population, estimated to be in the probably several hundreds per year in the U.S.
Now, the olaparib, that's being used alone or with chemo?
So this is with gemcitabine, and again, that's a point of discussion. Is gemcitabine the best cytotoxic backbone to be combined with a PARP inhibitor? And many would argue that it's probably not, that a true alkylating agent such as a platinum or a topo 1 inhibitor may be a preferable combination, but it's sort of hard not to have gemcitabine as part of the treatment in pancreas cancer, although again, I think that may change as we further study this class of drugs in subsets of people with pancreas cancer.
Is pancreatic cancer one of the tumors seen in the BRCA patients?
Yes. So about 7% of people may have a non-germline mutation of BRCA2 in pancreas adenocarcinoma, and a much smaller percentage, mostly BRCA2, but some 1 mutations occur in pancreas adenocarcinoma. And we know that those mutations are a little bit more prevalent in the Ashkenazi Eastern European Jewish population. And that's a population that we see quite frequently in New York. So we may have a slightly enriched population on the East Coast here in terms of patients with pancreas cancer and known BRCA mutations.
And have any objective responses been seen to PARP inhibitors?
Yes, there have been anecdotal objective responses. The ones that I know of all included a cytotoxic backbone. So I actually don't know of a single agent PARP inhibitor, although I think I've heard of a response, but I'm not certain about that myself. And that's also a research question, whether if one is going to explore PARP inhibitors in pancreas cancer in a formal way, whether we should bother looking at single agents or just move to combinations. And that's probably personally my vote, but from the academic point of view, it's certainly nice to know if there is single agent activity.
So what happened with this woman?
So for this lady, she ended up getting treated outside of a study, and her initial treatment for advanced disease is ongoing. She's getting gemcitabine and low-dose cisplatin.
How's she doing?
Symptomatically improved, will be restaged in the next couple of weeks, and that will give some insights. I think it's fair to say, though, she required bilateral VATS procedures and significant doses of steroids to address her effusions and lymphogenic component of her disease, respectively. That's also likely had an impact on her symptomatic improvement.
This case is a pretty good demonstration that we could use some new leads on treating this disease. Any new translational data sets of interest in pancreatic cancer?
I think the other kind of important piece of science that we're hoping will provide some new insights into therapeutic targets and what combinations of novel agents to utilize in clinical trials is the initial analysis of the 24 pancreas cancer genomes that were described by Jones and colleagues in Science in 2008, and that Bert Vogelstein elegantly took us through at the ASCO meeting this year. And that's, I think, very exciting. And the hope is that that will help sort of refine thinking in terms of which pathways we should be focusing the efforts on and which combinations of novel agents are best combined together.
What was seen there that struck you the most?
Well, I think one observation was that there was a lot in common between the 24 genomes that were analyzed, and that it was both pathways and genes, even though we consider pancreas cancer extraordinarily genetically complex and heterogeneous. To some extent, it was somewhat homogeneous. And given that the consistency of the pathways that were affected and may have been driving the development of the adenocarcinoma was noted across multiple genomes, that's a striking observation. And the fact that there was no universal explanation for why the pancreas cancer developed in the first place, probably that's not surprising. And from everything we know about pancreas adenocarcinoma, that's probably what one would have expected.
Anything in that work or anything else that's been done in the laboratory to maybe begin to explain the stromal activity of this disease?
So I think we're going to learn more as the work from that original analysis continues to unfold. I think the other areas in the advanced disease setting where we're looking at drug delivery and, you know, a very fundamental question in pancreas adenocarcinoma, does the drug actually get to the target? And in metastatic disease, this may not be so important, but in the primary tumor where we often see this very intense stromal reaction, this could be quite a significant area for highlighting avenues to improve outcomes. And we also know that the primary pancreas tumor is a very sort of hostile environment. It's remarkably hypovascular. So you can also argue, too, that that militates against effective drug delivery. And there are some very elegant models that David Tuveson and colleagues have studied in their mouse model of pancreas adenocarcinoma and have illustrated the importance of the stroma in terms of inhibiting drug delivery. Whether that holds true in people, yes, I think we don't know. But given that these mouse models are to some extent quite significantly replicative of the human pancreas condition, one certainly has to take some weight from those observations.